for example, you get an offer for $20,000 a year. So you're a graduate student, you've applied to school. You get a funding offer that says, here, we'll give you $20,000 a year to attend our school. That $20,000 a year is almost always attached to work. So you'll get that $20,000, but you have to work, for example, 2 teaching assistant jobs throughout the course of that year, or you'd have to work kind of a research assistant job out of the course of that year. There are kind of situations in certain departments that if you take another job within or find another source of funding, even if you take another job, then they'll pull funding from elsewhere. So that $20,000 ends up being kind of a cap of funding, a cap of money that you can make, no matter how much you're working. And what's been happening is that a lot of students are having to take jobs off campus. A lot of students are having to kind of stretch themselves out really thin just to make ends meet. We're also the primary, like we do primarily do a lot of the teaching on Burnaby Mountain, which is kind of secluded from a lot of other places. So it's also really difficult to get jobs, you know, off campus, yeah, where you're having to do kind of all that travel as well.
So, so you've been negotiating for a while, and what sort of finally pushed you to move towards a strike vote?
The concessions, for sure. Our experience historically with this university is that they do not budge. They do not kind of want to bargain. They delay. They're completely unserious. And they're unserious until we put pressure on them.
Right.
So we weren't getting anywhere at the bargaining table. We reached an impasse. So both our proposals were on the table and there was a disagreement. There are only a couple of options for us at that point. Either we can kind of put pressure through rallies and stuff, which hasn't been working, or we can go on strike. So we started hearing from membership that they wanted to go on strike because of these issues. We held a general membership meeting, and the membership decided to vote on to take a strike vote and say, look, we're tired of this. Let's cancel our bargaining sessions in April. They're not getting us anywhere, and let's hold a strike vote. So at that meeting, we actually got a unanimous yes to hold that strike vote. Over 100 members were present, and so we went to work to take this strike vote as well. We got to talk to more members across all 3 campuses in Surrey, Vancouver, and Burnaby. And that's, like you mentioned earlier, we ended up getting a 94% mandate to go on strike. So people are upset and they want to see something done about it.
So that's a pretty solid mandate. So what happens now? And I guess for students who might be listening, wondering about their semester, this doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go on strike right away. So, but what happens now?
Yeah, so it definitely does not mean that we're going to go on strike right away. So SFU has kind of responded with a couple of legal mechanisms that they can use, one of them being to take us to mediation. We're in mediation now. To determine whether or not we can get a deal done. We can't take any sort of job action until that mediation process
is complete. Just very briefly, how does mediation change the process from what you were doing before?
So essentially mediation you speak to a mediator at the labor board and they're talking to both sides and they're trying to come up with a compromise for this contract.
And if that doesn't work out, then what happens?
If that doesn't work out, then as the union would have to kind of decide on what the next steps are.
Right.
It all indications would be that we'd be taking some sort of job action.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you don't want to give up your strategy, but yeah. that can mean a lot of different things from, well, a lot of different things from picketing to a lot, well, a lot of different things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sometimes can be a common misconception is that strikes are the job actions, I should say, are just, you know, picket lines. Yeah. There's a kind of a variety of ways that we can interrupt or withhold our labor, and that is disruptive. So I'm sure everyone's kind of heard of grade withholding, which has been super effective for us in the past. I'm not going to say that that's a strategy or anything that we've decided on, but that's right. Something that happened in the past. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it looks like there's still a lot to go in this process.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in today and telling me about it.
Thank you so much. I
appreciate that. Felix Ruiz de la Orden is the chief steward and organizer for the Teaching Support Staff Union here at SFU. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CGSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CGSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cgsf.ca.
It's mushroom season here on Vancouver Island, and so many of us are out foraging in the woods searching for edible treasures emerging from the soil. What happens when we dig underground and look at the diversity of living creatures and microbes? On this episode, we're examining the connection between soil, antibiotics, and Borrelia burgdorferi, the bacteria that leads to Lyme disease. Dr. Kim Lewis is a researcher specializing in molecular science. He studies persister cells that lead to tolerance to antibiotics, uncultured bacteria of the environment, and the microbiome. Dr. Lewis is a university distinguished professor and director of the Antimicrobial Discovery Center at Northeastern University in Boston. Dr. Lewis also works on drug discovery, which is the process through which new medicines are identified. He joins us today from Boston. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Lewis.
Thank you, Sarah.
How did you become interested in studying Borrelia burgdorferi?
Well, my lab has been working on a number of infectious diseases, and I've been watching what's happening in the field of Lyme. And not much has been happening from my perspective. I mean, the pathogen that causes Lyme disease was very well defined as Borrelia burgdorferi. The treatment is pretty short with standard antibiotic doxycycline. But then a part of the patients, about 10%, go on to develop a condition that we do not understand very well, a chronic Lyme. And that's what piqued my interest to this disease.
Yes, well, I think many people would certainly agree with you that there hasn't been enough research done in this field. How did your research lead you to working with soil in relation to studying microbes?
Right. Well, most antibiotics that we currently have in the clinic come from soil microorganisms. So you will recall, penicillin, tetracycline, streptomycin. These are all probably common names that everybody recognizes. Soil microorganisms, bacteria and microfungi, as we call them, compete with each other and they fight out their differences with antibiotics. And then we borrow these compounds from them and use them to fight our pathogens.
So it's this whole battle that's happening underground that you're studying.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, that's amazing. And when you're working with soil, is the research methodology somehow different as opposed to just looking at microbes in a petri dish?
Well, it's only different in the sense that you need to isolate bacteria from soil. Therein lies a bit of a conundrum because only about 1% of bacteria that live in soil are going to grow on our petri dishes, and the rest are called uncultured or the microbial dark matter. And so that's one of the things that attracted me to this field. And we, with my colleague Slava Epstein, developed methods to grow these mysterious dark matter bacteria.
That sounds very intriguing. I definitely want to learn more about that.
So the phenomenon itself was described in late 19th century. So it's the oldest, the oldest unsolved problem in microbiology. And of course, you know, people spent a long time, 100 years to be exact, you know, tinkering with the media, trying to see if you add this or that, maybe you'll get more growth. But that didn't work out. So then we decided we'll do something different. We will grow soil bacteria where we know for a fact that they will grow, and that is in their natural environment. So we came up with a simple gadget, and we call it the diffusion chamber, where you take a sample of soil, you get the bacterial cells from that sample by simply shaking it with a little bit of water. And then those bacteria, we sandwich them between two semi-permeable membranes. And that device goes back into the soil. So now small molecules can pass through the pores of those semi-permeable membranes, but cells cannot. So now we have captured bacteria, and we're growing them essentially in a sterile environment and inside that chamber. We trick them because they don't know that something happened to them. They're in full contact with the molecules from their environment. And not surprisingly, they grow. Once they grow, then we can adapt them to growth on the petri dish. We call that domestication.
Domestication. I like that. And so what is the new antibiotic that you're looking at now that might be potentially used for treating Borrelia eventually?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. So we realized that some of the problems with antibiotics in general, and specifically with Lyme disease, is that antibiotics, while they will kill your pathogens, they will also in the process wreck your microbiome. So as we now more and more appreciate, they are useful bacteria or symbionts that live in the gut and affect almost every aspect of health and disease. And so we had a reason to believe that chronic Lyme, at least one component of chronic Lyme, may be a consequence of that wrecking of the microbiome when you're treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics. The only way to properly test that hypothesis, actually, is to get an antibiotic that only kills Borrelia burgdorferi, nothing else, doesn't harm your microbiome, and then see whether treating patients with that compound will prevent development of PTLDS. The immediate advantage, the immediate benefit to the patient from such a compound will be, of course, that you're not going to have side effects of damaging the microbiome, whether or not it's linked to chronic Lyme. Anyway, so we set out to search for such a compound, and we placed a bet on Mother Nature, if you will. Betting that nature would bother to evolve a compound to selectively kill spirochetes that live in the soil. Borrelia burgdorferi has a spirochete, right? It's sort of a spiral-shaped bacteria, a special group of bacteria. And so we started testing a soil bacteria from our collection against Borrelia burgdorferi for their ability to inhibit its growth. And in parallel, we tested them against some other common bacteria, staph. So everything that that killed Borrelia and staph were not interested in. That's your typical broad-spectrum antibiotic like doxycycline that's used to treat Lyme disease. And then we hit upon a particular bacteria, Streptomyces hygroscopicus, that was making something that only hit Borrelia burgdorferi, but not staph. So it was making a selective antispirochetal compound. And I was convinced that this is going to be a novel molecule because we don't know of any natural product antibiotic with that unusual property, only killing spirochetes. Yeah, but then when we determined the structure of this compound, it turns out that it's an old abandoned antibiotic called hygromycin A, discovered in 1953. So a very long time ago. And the reason I never heard of it, even though, you know, I study antibiotics all my life, is because it's a lousy antibiotic from conventional perspective. You know, it has very poor activity against our common pathogens like, you know, staph and strep and E. coli. But it's exquisitely potent against spirochetes like Borrelia burgdorferi or the spirochete Treponema pallidum that causes syphilis. So that's how we found this compound.
Oh, that's amazing. And that it's exquisitely potent and that it actually differentiates and targets the spirochetes sound very significant for your research.
Yep.
And what are biofilms?
Biofilms. So biofilms are it's a mass of bacterial cells. Let's say a typical case, you have a catheter and then it got contaminated with a bacteria. And that bacterial cell forms a colony, a mass of cells. That mass of cells covers themselves with an exopolymer, commonly known as probably it's gunk or something like that. and slime is a better word, probably.
Okay.
Slime, right. And that becomes extremely difficult to treat with antibiotics because most antibiotics don't act completely alone. They act sort of in concert with the immune system. So antibiotics kill some bacteria, then the immune system kills some bacteria, and you clear the infection. But this slime prevents the immune system from reaching into the biofilm. So now you need an antibiotic that will kill all bacteria. But that's very difficult to do because all bacterial species produce the small subpopulation of dormant cells that we actually discovered in the biofilm, which explains why the biofilm infection is often chronic and so difficult to treat.
And when you look under the microscope, what do those biofilms actually look like? Can you see them?
Oh, yes, of course. So it looks like the surface layer is going to be the slime. And then under the surface layer, there are going to be cells. And often the biofilm has architecture, has a sophisticated architecture with columns of cells and channels where liquid and nutrients can pass throughout the biofilm.
That's amazing. And then you've also been looking at persister cells. How do those function?
Yes. So I briefly mentioned those. The way those function is they go into dormancy. So let's say there's a growing population of cells like E. coli or staph. And then one thing that happens in all cells, including our cells, there is some genes that that have to be turned on in order for the cell to make proteins or to make energy. Those genes randomly turn off. It's sort of a low probability random event. We call that noise, molecular noise, if you will. And so now you got a cell where a gene that was supposed to be on and helping to churn out energy, that gene is off. So that cell goes into temporary dormancy. Well, while it went into dormancy, antibiotics cannot kill it because antibiotics kill active cells. They need active functions to corrupt them and kill. And you get to this small subpopulation of cells that survives the hit of antibiotic. When antibiotic concentration drops, those are the cells that are going to survive. They, mm-hmm. the biofilm or the population in the blood or whatever. And so you get a difficult to treat relapsing infection.
And are the Borrelia persister cells quite different then from other microbes?
No, they're not. So we studied persister cells of Borrelia. They are in principle similar. There are also genes that are noisy, and it's the energy producing genes that turn off with low probability and produce persisters that survive hit by antibiotics.
And do you see a difference in persister cells between acute or chronic Lyme?
Well, you see, in acute Lyme, of course, you have the pathogen, you have a mix of regular cells and persisters. In chronic Lyme, one of the very difficult issues with chronic Lyme is that we cannot detect the pathogen in patients with chronic Lyme. We cannot culture it or identify by other methods. So whether it's there or not, we do not know. It's possible that some cells are hiding somewhere, but it's also possible that the pathogen and treatment with broad spectrum antibiotics have wrecked the immune system. And now you're getting something that looks like an autoimmune disease or like long COVID, where the virus is probably gone from patients with long COVID. Again, it cannot be detected. But the symptoms, very, very similar to symptoms of chronic Lyme, persist.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, the similarities, really. Are there other strategies to eradicate persister cells?
Well, it's interesting that you asked. So one is, in a way, straightforward. So a number of years ago, we identified a antimicrobial compound that actually kills persisters, so it kills both regular cells and dormant cells. This compound has an amazing mechanism of action. It turns on degradation of proteins in the bacterial cell, and now the bacterial cell digests itself, right? So commits suicide. Probably one of the most amazing mechanism of actions for antibiotics that I know. Anyway, so while that's all, so that compound, it's with a long name, acyldepsipeptide. It is now in development for staph and several other common pathogens, but unfortunately doesn't act against Borrelia burgdorferi. So that's one approach. But we, of course, are on the hunt for other compounds that are going to have an ability to kill persisters of spirochetes as well. But the other approach it doesn't require any new antibiotics. So the other approach is based on the idea of pulse dosing, that we actually tested in a biofilm formed by staph, and it works pretty well in that case. And also in a test tube, also sterilizes Borrelia burgdorferi in a test tube, including its persisters. So you have, let's say, a population of bacteria in the test tube, regular cells and persisters. You add an antibiotic, something like amoxicillin, a conventional antibiotic. Kills regular cells, persisters are alive. Now you wash away the antibiotic, allow the persister cells to wake up, but not to restore the initial population. So now they're vulnerable, and you hit them with the next dose. You repeat that pulsing a couple of times, and you completely eradicate the population. So that is an example of how you can, by sort of clever dosing, you could, in principle, get rid of persisters.
That's great. What is next for you in the stages of drug discovery? That you can share with us.
Right, sure. I understand. So I cannot tell you everything because time and your viewers, though patient, I'm sure have a certain attention span. I'll tell you one thing that I'm pretty excited about at the moment and that my team is working on. So we've been wondering, is there a group of bacteria on planet Earth that has the same requirements for antibiotics as we do? What is our current need in antibiotics? The current need is for compounds that are going to be non-toxic, that are going to be effective against particularly nasty pathogens like gram-negative bacteria, and Borrelia falls into that category. Not much compounds discovered against that. Very tough to finance you against that group. It's going to travel through the tissue, so it would be systemically available. All those good things that we expect from an antibiotic. So we're wondering if there's a group of bacteria that actually had to acquire antibiotics with exactly these properties. And we hit upon such a group of bacteria. And these are symbionts that live in the gut of nematodes. So nematodes are little worms that live in the earth. Many of these nematodes, the ones that we're particularly interested in, they're called entomopathogenic nematodes. They infect insect larvae. The larvae release antibiotics and help protect that food source. And then the nematode and this bacteria called Photorhabdus eats up the larvae. But these compounds that the Photorhabdus releases, they have to be able to travel through the tissues of the nematode. They have to be non-toxic to the little worm, and they have to be able to kill the nasty bacteria that attack that food source. And those bacteria are very similar to our pathogens. So that sort of fulfills that entire list. Now, these nematodes, by the way, you can buy them on Amazon. Yeah, they're sold on Amazon for gardeners. You can sort of take those nematodes, sprinkle your favorite, and it'll not be chewed up by insects. So we went looking for new antibiotics in that group of bacteria, and we found several new antibiotics. One class with really, really fantastically interesting compounds that we published 2 years ago, Durobactins. And now we have two more groups of bacteria coming out of that class. And that sort of tells us that looking for creatures that have had similar requirements as we for medicines can be a very productive way of finding new drugs.
Oh, that just sounds remarkable. Well, we will be following all of your research closely and love to have you back on the podcast to tell us more in the future.
Thank you, Sarah.
That was Dr. Kim Lewis with literally his groundbreaking research. I know many of you are following, and we all hope this leads to a new effective treatment. I love learning about this exquisitely potent antibiotic that doesn't damage the microbiome. How lucky we are that he placed a bet with Mother Nature. Thank you everyone for listening. Stay safe in the outdoors.
That's our show for today. You've been listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Teevil, and I've been your host for the last hour. Tune in tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. sharp for another edition of Speak Up with your host, Vivian. And on Wednesday, you can tune in for Intravenous, also at 10 a.m. Coming up in just a few minutes is Democracy Now! Stay tuned. Keep on listening to CJSF. We'll see you tomorrow.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
pigeon rap,
and anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.